Are you looking to optimize your performance, grow your mind, and change your system? Well, you've come to the right place. I'm Brad Baker.
And I'm Tom Brobeck.
And this is the Bold Base Performance Podcast.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the show. I'm Tom Brobeck, and my guest today is Ryan Banta. Ryan is a teacher and track and field coach at Parkway Central High School in Chesterfield, Missouri. Ryan's teams have seen enormous success on the track, including multiple state records, nationally ranked runners, and state champions. Ryan is the author of the Sprinter's Compendium, a complete guide to sprinting with input from 50 of the top sprint coaches in the world. Make sure you check out more about Ryan in the show notes. Let's continue to grow the mind and change the system. There's a spectrum of performance and health, and sometimes people get too far into performance and they get too far into health. And then we look at, you know, and my example is always like intermittent fasting. It's like, well, that's great for health. Is that actually great for performance? Maybe not, right. Maybe so. And then for performance, it's like, how is this affecting you later on when you're no longer a competing athlete? So how have you balanced that spectrum of performance and health as you have grown as a coach?
Well, so the biggest thing is, you know, you start out with it all being your X's and O's first, and that's all you really care about. And you just want to just get the maximum absolute performance out of your athletes. And so you're looking for the really enticing, sexy training methods, the most extreme training methods. And you go there because that's what's the neatest, most new, novel thing. And then what happens through that is you come across, oh crap, I'm getting a lot of injuries in the same realm with the same spots at the same time. So what is this that I'm doing that's leading to these kids getting blown up? And then because we're blowing them up, then they're not being able to get to the performance thresholds that need them to get to maximize their abilities. So then you have to figure out, how do I build in recovery methods, injury prevention modality, prehab, rehab, things like that. But most coaches who get into coaching are all about the performance numbers, not about the restoration. They're always more worried about the 2 hours in practice, give or take, versus the 22 to 21 hours that they're away from you, which could be more important, but way less sexy. And so that's in my profession. You know, my very first year as a coach, we had so much success and I just worked them really hard and they got better. But for the most part, they were better in spite of me than because of me. And then after that, I got my comeuppance and we weren't very good for 4 years. Athletes were getting injured. Athletes weren't enjoying it. Athletes weren't having fun, you know, and we were running into a buzzsaw of competition that I couldn't overcome with my limited knowledge and my very limited focus, which was sprint focused and performance focused and not worried about what I would say is the global person, which includes recovery, restoration, nutrition, sports psychology, and yes, the X's and O's, and then your team culture.
Sure. Do you think a coach has to go through that kind of initial failure period to be successful later on? Like, is that a necessary step to grow and develop and actually get to an elite level?
Yeah, I would say that failure is really important. I remember Dan Path was talking about how he put together this crazy periodization scheme for one of his high jumpers, you know, and he coached him into an average athlete from an elite athlete. And then he stopped doing all this crazy training and interventions and all this kind of stuff. And he said, just go play basketball for a couple months. And the guy started jumping back over 7 foot in the high jump again versus, you know, 6'6". I think that there's something to be said for that. Most of the great coaches I know have had massive failure or have had some sort of awakening that something was going on in their program with a problem that they couldn't fix. And they were forced to become very creative or forced to search out people who've already won that battle. And then they're the mentors that are so important, or the solution that comes out of the problem. So like, I look at problems like a hurdle in your way as being the actual path. So the object, the discomfort, the challenge ends up becoming the path. It ends up becoming the way, because you're forced at that point to deal with this immovable, repeatable problem. And then once you've figured out solutions to that, or found somebody who can help guide you to those, all of a sudden that becomes your biggest strength, because you now have learned how to do that. And hopefully you've now been able to connect the dots to that problem solving method to solve other problems that will show up and come down. And then what's going to be really challenging is, if you coach more than a decade, kids start to change because of not their biology, but because of how they're being reared and raised. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to have new problems that you didn't have before. That's going to force you to adjust and to be a lifelong learner. If you don't do that, if you don't adjust, you don't become a lifelong learner, you're going to have a period of great success because you figured it out once and it's going to work for a while. And then slowly but surely, it's not going to be repeatable, and it's going to force an adjustment, or you're going to be out of the sport.
So to use my track analogy here, most people see life or their career as a sprint, but you see it as a hurdle race. And then when an event in your life, like the steeplechase, comes up, you're better prepared for that because you've already overcome the hurdles. Whereas most people have only sprinted, and they see every hurdle or the steeplechase just as obstacles that weren't even supposed to be there. But when you have those built-in obstacles, you prepare yourself for future similar ones down the road.
100%. And we actually tell our hurdlers, specifically to that metaphor, you're not a hurdler until you fall. So when you fall, it's a big deal. And we congratulate the girls and we cheer and we make a big celebration about it. And they're like, what the hell's going on? What, this is not something to celebrate. It's like, no. You've now stretched yourself. You've done something aggressive. You've done something, and now you're going to be forced to learn because you've fallen, and you have to pick yourself back up off the track and then go attack this and problem solve this hurdle, which literally is metaphorically and symbolically exactly what we have to do to grow as people. And that's what I love about the sport. And we definitely tie that in specifically to hurdles, which is really, it carries over to all the things we face in life. I mean, you're really, really successful and everything comes really easy, you don't learn anything. You never get great. I mean, Michael Jordan, you know, watching the Last Dance.
Yeah.
He's a superstar, but he had to learn things and challenge himself to level up his game and to include his teammates and to trust his coach to reach the highest heights that any player in any sport has ever accomplished, even though, you know, fundamentally, he might be one of the greatest players of all time, you know, and even late into his career, when the 3-point shot became a bigger part of his game, or his game in general, but the NBA, his percentage got better in that,
right.
You know, so people talk about, well, maybe his game wouldn't have translated. Yeah, it would have, because you could see that in his final years, you know, take away obviously his time with the Wizards, but he played really well with the Wizards and was a game changer for them. I mean, took them from being like 30 something in defense all the way down to the top 10, you know, just by getting himself back into the swing of things. And I feel like those challenges are what refresh us as coaches and make us excited to do what we do and to prove that we can solve the problems. Because it's not really the system and our drills and our exercises and the X's and O's, but instead it's our method to solving the unknown problems that come to us and being robust enough to fix them where it doesn't derail us, and we could still be as successful under this new paradigm that we were before. So like, COVID is a challenge. I am going to start my track and field season this year not knowing half of my program because I only got 2 weeks with the sophomores and I've had no time with these freshmen. Right. And a lot of kids aren't going to be out because their parents are concerned with COVID and the methods. And then our competitions are going to look different. Our protocols are going to look different. So you don't even get to the X's and O's before all that stuff gets solved. And the most robust coaches who have a good system of dealing with challenges,
yes,
are the ones who are going to be the best.
I was just going to say that the coaches that have pushed themselves, that have failed, that have tried new things, it, and they didn't even know it, but COVID is a huge slap in the face. And the ones that have probably failed the most are going to succeed the most this year, next year, because they've already hit those walls or those hurdles or fallen, and they know how to deal with that and to rebound.
Correct.
Another thing with your hurdlers. So if you had one hurdler and you said, you're not going to be great until you fall during a, you know, during a hurdle practice race, and then you have another hurdler and you tell them, don't ever fall, don't ever fall, you're saying the one who fails first is going to succeed long term.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I, again, I would say,
which makes sense, but our society preaches don't fail, don't fail, don't fail. And when you put it in this paradigm, it's like, oh, actually, maybe let's fail first and then we'll succeed from there.
100%. When I did my student teaching at this high school, that's a great high school, and I met probably the best social studies teacher I've ever seen. He put up a picture of two different women and he said, what's more oppressive? He had a woman that was dressed in traditional Muslim garb, and then he had a heroin chic 1980s model. And right there, you could already see where maybe he's going to take that conversation. And he took it for an hour plus. So I'm like, I got to work with this guy. This guy's the most amazing. I've never seen anybody captivate an entire audience for an hour with just two pictures and one question. But he was such a master that he expected I was going to be at his level right out of the gate, and there was no way. And so I failed a ton. I made every flipping mistake that you could make that wouldn't get you thrown in jail, right? You know, and, right. And when I came out of it, I was prepared, very prepared for my first year as a teacher, because I'd experienced a little bit of it as a coach. I coached before I taught, but it was those failures in the classroom that has sustained a lot of my day-to-day success as a true blue teacher when I have my own classroom. And so I tell kids, guys, you got to fail. You've got to go through this stuff. You've got to be challenged. If it doesn't happen, like, I can't imagine where I would be as a coach if I didn't have those 4 years after my first year where I really struggled and had my colleagues basically pull me aside and said, look, we got to do better. You got to be better. If I wasn't challenged, I would have never went to USATF schools. I would have never found EliteTrack.com. I would have never ran into Carl Valley. I would have never ran into, you know, Kaba Tolbert. I eventually would have never met Dan Path. And I would have been maybe an average high school coach when I had talent. But because of that experience, it, that trimming, you know, nipping something in the bud, right? You nip it off and, oh, that sucks, because that's a disappointment. You're now not going to get that flower off of that particular part of that stem or branch.
Right.
But what it's going to allow is for the other flowers, the other fruit, to really grow and become robust from having that trimming, that bad situation, to force these other things to really become the wonderful, delicious fruit or beautiful flower that they need to be.
We see that a lot in physical therapy, where an athlete gets hurt and then they address these deficits that maybe they knew about, maybe they didn't, maybe they ignored. Do you see that with your athletes in track? The ones that get hurt early on, they take an ownership of their health and fitness and come back better than ever?
Yeah. So we had a young lady. I think that's the challenge is sometimes, you know, what is the mother of all invention is desperation, right? Mm. And so, and I know I'm brutally destroying that quote, but it goes something to that effect. And we had a young lady who could never stay healthy. I mean, every injury you could possibly get, every mistake that could happen, all of these problems. But eventually, she, thank goodness, she stayed with it,
right,
and ended up not only being the most improved athlete in the 5K and the 3200 statewide, she was a state qualifier, she was all state and cross country, she earned an opportunity to be a member of Mizzou's track and field team, got a lot better. You know, we had a young lady who was a sprinter, who never, you know, had a frustratingly disappointing end of her freshman year, even though she was incredibly talented. But because of that and her resilience and my mentorship as well, we doubled down on certain things and we attacked the other things that weren't great. And, you know, she was the biggest, most important change element in the performance output of my program, because she became so much better through that process by checking off all the dots. You know, and then no one could beat her in practice. She became so strong, so good. So what did that end up doing? It forced the other girls who wanted to run with her, toe the line with her, roll with her, they had to go through that same process. And that led us to have a state championship in the 4x2, state championship in the 4x4, state record in the 4x8. And she was on all of those relays with a collection of different girls in every one of those other sprints, you know? And all of a sudden my program rose because of this one kid who had a very disappointing freshman year, got kind of beat up and blown up, and then had to radically change. Different athlete. And this is unique. I don't know if you remember Jeremy Macklin, played for the Philadelphia Eagles for a long time, All-American at Mizzou. Considered when he was at Mizzou, probably the fastest kick returner in the league, one of the fastest guys in all of college football. He did not run track at Kirkwood High School because he was afraid that the college recruiters would know that he wasn't fast.
Oh, wow.
He goes to Mizzou, which side story, I pushed him to switch from Oklahoma to Mizzou because Oklahoma was going to make him play defensive back. I'm like, you're not a defensive back. You're the best wide receiver I've ever seen in high school. And I worked at Kirkwood and I did my student teaching there as well. But anyway, he went to Mizzou. I was happy because, you know, he had Chase Daniel there, great college quarterback. And he got hurt right away, tore up his knee. So for the first time ever, Jeremy had to actually really train, work on his craft, work on, like you said, moving fundamentally better, smoother, with better technique, biomechanically sound. And all of a sudden, all that work and all that speed training, made him a hell of a lot faster. And then he became one of the fastest guys and had a very solid career in the NFL. And he would have never that it, and if it wasn't for his freshman year taking a real weird awkward pass on the sideline and tearing his knee up and being forced to do all the things that he had never done before, because that's going to be the difference between him making it or not. And then sure enough, that paid dividends and eventually became a pro and was one of the fastest guys in the NFL.
Absolutely. How do you teach your kids then? It's everything right now is about instant gratification. And in athletic development and careers, you're not going to peak every single meet. You're not going to peak as a freshman. You can't always peak all the time. At some point, there's going to be some delayed gratification. There's going to be, this is better for tomorrow than it is today. How do you instill that in your athletes to buy into the program and teach them, like, this is a four-year process and you're going to have some bumps along the way?
So the most beautiful thing about track and field is we can chart data. And so Mile Split runs their stat side of their website. They have all of these charts built around progressions. And so we can show our athletes, you know, hey, look at this trend line. Yeah, there's ups and downs. And, you know, the trend line we want to see in the anything running is we want to see it go the opposite of what we want to see in the stock market, right? We want to see that trend going farther and farther and farther down from a high peak down to the lowest we can get it over a trend. Mm-hmm. So that happens over the course of 4 years. And thankfully we have numerous examples of that because we make sure all that information and all that performance data gets put into that for every athlete in every discipline. So they can see it for the long jump, the shot put discus, they can see it for the runs and the jumps, and they can see all of that stuff move in the direction that they need to. Now, of course, individually, some kids just hunt for the negative. So then, okay, let's put it, you know, time over you, you know, so how do we know that you're improving if you don't believe the examples that I have in front of you?
Right.
Well, one of the problems with rank, record, and publish is that you can't PR all the time. So, you know, Tony, what does he do? He changes the test, which is good. The other thing that you could do is, besides just change the test, use the rolling average, right? Which is the, Brendan Thompson wrote about that in Simply Faster in one of his articles. So then what you do is you take the strength of Tony's thing and you take the strength of this idea of the psychology of it and you blend them together. And now you've got something where you're like, look, yeah, you had that one time where there was a hot girl on the track and you were really focused. And for some reason you got 10 hours of sleep that night. There was a hurricane wind behind you, you know, and it was 70 plus degrees and sunny. You were dopamined out of this world and you had a great individual performance. But but then all of your other averages outside of that one outlier doesn't match up. So having that rolling average being a major component to, you know, record or rank and publish is essential. And so I do that, not necessarily with the shorter things all the time. I mean, now everybody's getting timed all the time.
Right.
Okay. Everybody's getting timed in my program. There's a stopwatch on everybody at all times, but my data isn't going to be as important to you as your data is to yourself. So it's important to have historical comparisons within your own program to then be able to say, hey, within this window or within these guardrails on the road, you're on this flow chart over here. And here are all the other people that have done the things you've done to this point. And here's their traditional progress. Here's where you're at right now in my program. Here's your rolling average. And then here are your times on intervals that you're doing in my system. So that helps. And that allows buy-in. It's hard at first because you don't have a lot of that data when you first out. You have to accumulate that to make clear distinctions on where they're going to go and what they're going to do. So the other thing is, like when I have time trials, we know what the window of improvement will be in that year based on that time trial on average. So I can tell a kid, hey, like if you're a freshman and you run 67 in the 400 meter dash in our first time trial, you're going to run 60 flat. And for a Missouri high school kid, 60 flat's a solid girl's time. Now, if you're a returner, you're only going to improve 4 seconds versus the seven. But those averages are pretty strong. And then it comes to you to, it's really up to you to outdo that average, right? So you can not do anything and you won't match that. Or you can work really, really hard and be one of the outliers on the positive end by really dropping even more time off your performance or adding more distance to your throws, whatever it may be.
I really like that because I don't think kids conceptually know how much they should improve or can improve or what's expected. Obviously faster is always better, but if you give them a number, hey, you like the average person improves 4 seconds from this year, like let's try and beat that. And if they only improve 2 seconds, they probably can do some self-auditing. What can I do to be better to, you know, get myself up? And if they're doing 5 or 6 seconds, they can be not complacent, but a little more, you know, rewarding to themselves. Like I am getting better. I'm getting better at a faster pace. I'm doing the right things and have some of that confidence, especially the young, you know, freshman sophomore, when they don't really know what they're good at or should they stick with this event or do they even like track? I think those, another thing I want to touch on quick, it really helps when you've been at a school consistently, because your data to me means nothing because I don't know any of your runners. But if you show me the data when I was in high school from the high school I went to of the year and 2 years and 3 years and 4 years before, say, oh, I remember that kid. He's a good athlete, or she was a fast runner. And that gives me more context to how can I improve based on this data that's relevant to me. So as coaches, we're always looking for our best situation, but sometimes that consistency with the kids can actually help you with the results you're going after.
Exactly. And so when people look at like, you know, rank, record, publish, and they're like, well, you know, there's only this many people in the NFL that run a 40 at that time. Those times are BS. First of all, even if they're BS, which they're not, okay, you can apply that to show growth. It's about growth. It's about your individual growth. It's how many kids have improved in your program. And then on top of that, it's how many kids are now starting to hit these standards. And then those standards can be extrapolated out to showing what you think they can do and what they can match out to. And so when people complain about you posting results, it's part of holding your kids accountable to themselves. Right. It's not so much for Tom and Ryan to go, oh, well, he's got 10 and I got 11, you know.
Yep.
It's not about that. It's totally not about that. It's about holding the kids accountable, showing improvement, showing growth, rewarding them with promoting them, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's the idea. Like in our program on Mondays or Tuesdays, typically Tuesdays, actually, we do our PR candy bar handout. And I know people are like, oh my God, you're handing out candy bars, processed food, sugar, blah, blah, blah. Get out of here. It's okay for kids to have treats once in a while. And so what I do is every kid, every week, we do a little debrief of the weekend of you know, last week's performances, how many PRs you got. And, you know, Susie will stand up and I got a PR on the 100, 200 and long jump. We clap three times. Mm-hmm. She sits down, she comes up, grabs her three candy bars and she sits back down. Now, Susie could be the worst kid on your team, but the goal is to make Susie the most improved kid on your team. And so then she's getting love and excitement and highlights and buy-in by she's getting better all of the time.
Right.
You know, and so where I've got a girl, Kaylin Tate, who's top 20 in the nation in the indoor 60. Mm-hmm. Well, she's going to take longer and longer to PR and it's going to go farther and farther into the season. It's going to become harder and harder to get those PRs. So she's getting all the glory and love and excitement because she's just breaking people's hearts on the track all the time, you know, but then little Susie, she's going to get the PR and boost from her teammates and her coaches that, hey, we value you just as much as I value this girl who's top 20 in the nation, you know, and I'm blessed to have both of you, not just her, both of you, because you, Susie, hold everyone else accountable in front of you because they might not be PRing and they might not be because of the Kaylin situation because she's got so much talent and has hit these times. They might be just slacking, you know, where Kaylin isn't, but the girls in between you and Kaylin might be. And so you're holding them accountable by kicking butt and taking names and getting better and proving that it works for you and proving the value of putting in that work because you are getting something out of it. And we have reminders because, you know, like when you're on a team, it's hard to know who's really getting better and at what.
Right.
And in sports that aren't so clear cut like track and field, that's super difficult. You know, but track has that as an advantage and swimming does too. So we should leverage that. Or if you're in a, you know, a team sport, then it is the fly 10s, the fly 20s, you know, your deadlift, your clean and jerk, those become measurements for some of those guys that may not be getting the love on the field or on the court, but they can get the love from their coach and in their team and should be rewarded. And it should be highlighted by the coach and the head coach, not just the strength and conditioning guy, because then they are getting recognized by the biggest dude on the team for them. And that's important too. And I feel like that's kind of missing that connection between rewarding those guys by the head coach.
I was just going to say, it seems like a really good balance between rewarding what ultimately matters, which is performance, but also rewarding improvement because that matters too. And you can't have a system where performance doesn't matter and it's only improvement because then they were competing. And if you're in basketball, someone needs to score 20 points for you. If you're in track, you need, you know, kids to run fast. But if you're only rewarding performance at some point, it's only about three or four kids and all these other kids feel a little bit inadequate, a little bit glossed over, a little bit pushed to the side. So it seems like you've done a really good balance of rewarding both of those kind of metrics, or should we say?
That's the hope and the goal. And we do some other things too, where we try to give our upperclassmen and returners added responsibilities in the team, which also is a reward too, even though it's work, to organize things and to manage things, to be kind of someone's cohort within the program, a big sister or a big brother. But those kids that get it understand that. And they like that. They like having a little bit more responsibility and actually having something functional to do mm-hmm. besides just being elected in a popularity contest as a captain. So we try to weave all of these things together. And again, when your listeners hear this, and one of my criticisms is, you know, that people have for me, which is true. They're like, we're very sophisticated or complex. And that's a problem. I can't do all this stuff. We're not going to do it all right away. You pick one thing, you get really good at that. It becomes part of your program. You pick another thing that doesn't interrupt the things that you just got really good at. You add that to your program. You figure that out. And eventually it just runs and you have this robust program where all the kids and all your assistant coaches understand it. And it becomes what looks like from the outside to be very intricate. But day to day, if you would come to my practice, you're like, well, this doesn't seem that hard, you know, because it just becomes the very nature of what you're doing on a daily basis with good management and debriefs and communication with the athletes and the coaches and your captains.
How do you keep injured kids involved in your program, engaged in their rehab, and part of the track, you know, program community?
So the biggest thing is injured or not, every athlete in my program checks in with me every day, and we have them there. They're a part of the team huddle. I make sure that I check in with all of my kids who have to go see the trainer as a group. We talk mm-hmm. about how they're feeling, where they're at, their progress. Are things improving? Are things not improving? Trying to help manage, massage, or even direct them to good therapists, whether it's a massage therapist, a sports psychologist, a nutritionist, chiropractor, whatever it may be. And I have people that I trust that I use for that. Another thing I'll do is I'll have my alumni athletes who have come across a situation like this, and they will actually reach out to those athletes with a letter or a note or an email. Typically, I'll be the one that hands that letter or note or email to them, like print it out, you know, because, you know, again, we have alumni connecting with high school kids, that gets a little odd, not right. nearly as bad amongst a single gender. But that's something that we do. We're lucky enough to have a really good therapist in our school. He's probably the best PT guy we've ever had. Mm-hmm. So he and I, that's really important. You got to be talking to them every day. Before practice, I usually have the last hour of the day off. I'll usually go check in with him, mm-hmm. say, where are we at? What did you see yesterday with the particular athlete? I then follow up with the athlete and have that same conversation. And I'd usually try to do it at the end of practice when and where I can. When we do our drills and our workouts, you've got to make sure that you have your A workout, whatever that is for the day. And then you got to have your B, C, D, and E. And that's where planning really becomes important. It's not so much how many reps, the meters, the distance, but what is the theme of the day? What are we trying mm-hmm. to accomplish?
Right.
And so when a kid comes to you in your program, you have the ability to then put the B, C, D, and E in for them because it's already been planned on that theme. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel or try to come up with some cockamamie thing. You've already got modules of workouts set up for them.
And can then when we sorry to interrupt you, but can you give yeah. me a specific example of that? Because that makes a lot of sense to me. I've never heard it spelled out in that way, but give me an example for a day where what a B and C workout would look like.
Totally. So if we're doing, hold on, just pulled the thing out of my ear. So if we're doing, you know, like acceleration, right? And the athlete has a hamstring problem.
Yep.
We would maybe do really, really heavy sled with very far forward leans where we're working the quad, the glutes, and not the hammies in that push. Or they might drag it backwards, you know, so even backwards action might be better. We ask the athlete first, can you sprint? No. Can you jog? No. Can you dribble? No. Can you walk? Okay. Now then when we've got that information, what we can or cannot do, then you build your program around that. Mm-hmm. Drills. So what we'll do with our drills is if we're doing like, let's say an A skip, well, they can't A skip. We'll still do a marching version of that, you know, where they're still getting the foot into that place or into that position. If they can't do like a backwards, you know, C skip, then they'll do it walking. You know, we'll do lunges in place of quick leg, you know, action. You know, because it's still, you're still using that cycle and all of that. Mm-hmm. If we're going to do stuff on a bike, so like, let's say they can't run, they can't do any of that, but we still want to do acceleration. I will squeeze the seat down and have them really crunched up and push on the bike with a very, very, very short, you know, squeezed action like you would in that position when you're accelerating.
Sure.
Then what we do is we will try to add about 20% of volume to make up for 20% of not going against gravity in that action. Then if I'm going to do maximum velocity action, I will raise the seat way, way, way up. Mm-hmm. And then that foot's going to be stretched as far as it can and strike through the ground as much as it can. Now, if they have a joint, a leg or whatever that cannot be done in that process, then we will have them do whatever they can with all of the other appendages, specifically the opposite leg, opposite arm, right. to get this idea of that crossover effect to still yes. build it in. So I had a young lady, the Lauren girl that I was telling you about earlier, that sure. and I'm going to give you her protocol. So what we did, now I was a younger coach, I wasn't married, you know, I didn't have any kids, none of this stuff. So I could sacrifice all my time to get this kid right. The doctor told her, you can race, but I don't want you to do any load-bearing running throughout the week. So then we implemented that stuff. So we tried to figure out, okay, if you were going to run a 400 meter dash today in practice, all right, we want to, at the bare minimum, be on the bike at nearly the same speed and turnover that you would be on the bike for that amount of time, plus 20%, to overcome the differences with not being loaded against gravity. Okay. Then what she would do when we're on the bike, we would do that. Then when we would do tempo days, we would deep water run, and I would throw tennis shoes on her so that the feet didn't just flop in the water, because the tennis shoe actually provides a similar feel of pull against gravity and rotation, where it's not just knees being driven, but that, you know, the calf, the Achilles, and the foot are still getting some sort of load as it's going against the weight of the shoe. Now, of course, you know, people don't want you getting in the pool with dirty shoes, but I don't give a damn. Okay. This kid ended up helping us, you know, win a 4x2 state title, a 4x4 title, and the next year helped us break the 4x8 state record, you know.
Focus on details. Well, like, where did you get the pool? Is it the pool at the school? Like, so I'm water running, how, like, what ways?
Yes. So we did two. So on the days that we couldn't get into the school because it was too early, and if we were going to do it in the morning, because we would rotate when we did things, sure, she and I would go to the YMCA. I got a pass, got permission from her parents, got permission from the athletic directors and all this kind of stuff. And we would do it at the Y. We would just sneak the shoes on and kind of, you know, make sure nobody saw us when we got in there. And sorry, YMCA, you know, probably had to throw a little chlorine in the pool, but regardless, we would do that there. And then sometimes it would happen at different points, and then we do have a pool at the school. And when the pool is available, we would do that. But we have a swim team, we have a water polo team, and we have club swim. So the availability of our pool was pretty limited. And then, you know, we would rotate those things on the bike, and we would try to simulate the repetitions and the speed of the rotation, and then add 20%, whether it was acceleration crunched up, whether it was maximum velocity extended. And then in the pool, same thing. We, you know, you're not going to go the same speed on tempo in the pool as you would on the track, but you can, again, add a little bit of load on there, 10 to 20% to deal with that as well. Then when all of our girls were warming up and, you know, doing all their drills and all that stuff, she was allowed to lift weights. So then we lifted anything we could, weight bearing that we could, that wouldn't expose that leg to being any more hurt or harmed. And it was up to pain, but she would be able to do all that. So then that's how we artificially dealt with the absence of gravity, right? Is by loading up her skeletal system to handle that. Right. Even though that stress reaction was in the femur. Okay. Then when she was done with that, we would have her come out and she would do seated runs. Okay. On the ground where she's pumping her arms with the seated runs for every interval and every sprint that her teammates were doing to attack the load of the upper body and the arm swing and arm carriage.
Right.
And then we would add in medicine ball work and things like that, that didn't involve a hop, just a projection of force, but not leaving our feet,
right,
to deal with the block start thing and all that kind of stuff. So that was a very specific protocol for a very specific kid who was a long sprinter, you know, 400, 800. And she qualified to state in the 2 1 year. She's a stud. She was our school record holder in the 400. She's now like hardcore CrossFit. She could beat you and I up both at the same time. I mean, she's amazing.
Well, it sounds like it, because most kids aren't going to attack rehab like that. They're going to be, oh, I can't do track. I guess I'm going to sit out for 4 to 6 weeks and hopefully I'm better by the time I come back. It seemed like she had a different mindset going into it to start.
And as coaches, we have to do that. And we have to create protocols that we can to build around whatever that issue is, to get them back as fast as they can without getting hurt. You know, this whole idea of taking complete days off under rehab is, I shouldn't say complete days off, long periods of multiple days off in a row, right, is a huge problem. Actually, what they found is if you hit them really hard, like I told you with that protocol, and then give them another day off, if it would be like, let's say an ACL tear or something like that, and then giving them the day off in the middle and then be aggressive again on Wednesday, that actually shows, because it, I mean, think about how you lift weights, think about how you train. Why would rehab be any different? And like, oh, we're rehabbing, we're touching that thing all the time, every day. We never give it a chance to rest. So then you got to think about how you would manage something like that and maybe changing your protocol to give it boom hard, super easy, boom hard, super easy, so the body can super compensate and get better.
So are there times when a doctor or PT or athletic trainer or coach, whoever, tells you, hey, this athlete can't practice, like maybe they should just go home, and you're like, no, there's an in-between that we have found success with. Let's see if we can work together to keep this athlete engaged and motivated. Have you had those conversations with other medical professionals or other sporting professionals?
Yeah, the worst thing that you can do as a coach is allow the athletes, the parents, and the PT person to do whatever they want without your input.
Right.
It's very important to be a part of the guide. I always look at the coach should be, you know, in that triangle of trust when it comes to, you know, rehab. So you've got yourself, you've got the physical therapist, and you have the doctor, right? And that's that triangle. And I believe that all of them are equally important because, you know, most doctors are not masters of the sport that we coach. Even if they're right. A good orthopedic doctor, they don't know about training methods and all that stuff. All they know about is I take this slice, I screw this thing here, and this is going to lead to a functionality later. You know, the therapist provides good general therapies that they've trained, but because every sport is different and every athlete is different, it's good to have that conversation. And, right. And I make sure, and our trainer that we have right now, again, is so good mm-hmm. that we can sit down and he'll even come up with some schemes. He's like, hey, I think this is great. We should do this. I'm like, yeah, let's try this. And he'll talk to mom. I'll talk to mom and dad, you know, and that's good too, to kind of, and we're all on the same page and what we're trying to do and how we're trying to get things done. And most of the time we get it right. You know, we had one kid that we didn't get it right for, but again, the kid is a big part of the process. And so are the parents mm-hmm. and they weren't doing smart things. You know, like you can't be in a rehab cycle and then go play gator ball in gym B on a wood floor and expect that you're not going to pull a hamstring or right. repeatedly injure yourself. And the problem is if you mess it up, you go way down farther in the rehab protocol. It's going to be that much longer. I don't know anybody who's hurt themselves worse and that worked out for the better. It's just going to lengthen the recovery process. So I try to talk with them. Now, the other thing I'll do is before they go into the trainer, I ask a lot of questions. What happened? Where did you feel it? Was it a pop? Was it a squeeze? Did you feel something give away? 10 being the worst pain ever, 1 being no pain. Do you have bruising? You know, because sometimes you can't see where the injury is. You get yourself fired if they show where the injury is.
Right.
You know, so talk to me about that. Simple things, stupid things. Hey, when you sit down on the toilet, does it hurt? On that muscle, on the hamstring. If it hurts when you sit down on the toilet, weird thing in my own experience, that's a tear. It's not a cramp. It's a tear. And it means it's a little bit more severe because it's not neural. There's some damaged tissue when you put that hamstring under pressure sitting on the commode where it doesn't feel good. The other thing I'll do is we have a restoration station in our practice where we'll have foam rollers, the stick, stretchy bands. And I have a book called, which is Kelly Starlet. I'm sure you've heard of him.
Yep.
He's got this book called Becoming a Supple Leopard. So instead of sending your athletes automatically to the trainer, maybe there's drills and exercises that Kelly Starlet has already put together that you don't need to go see a therapist. You can do this stuff at home. And then you'll find out that maybe 2 or 3 days later with some rest and some of these exercises, that problem, that tendonitis you have right on your kneecap disappears, you know, or that tight spot you had on your adductor muscle was not a tear. It was a cramp and your neurological system guards really strong. And now we've been able to calm it down. It doesn't hurt as much because, you know, it's the old joke. You go to the doctor and you said, hey, doc, it hurts when I swing my arm like this. And doc goes, well, don't swing your arm like that for 2 to 6 weeks. Well, now you've lost your ability as the coach to be the bridge to get them over the hump of the injury faster. Now they don't get to go across the bridge. They got to walk all the way down around the valley, wade through the water, and climb up the other side to get to the thing they could have got on the bridge and got across really quickly. And so I don't want anybody to get hurt. I don't want anybody to get injured. Right. That's the other thing too. Once you ask all those questions, you get that information, you pretty much know, like, oh, this is a tear, this is a joint issue, this is a stress fracture, you know, like, hey, is it unilateral or bilateral? If it's unilateral and it's real hot and it's low on that leg, right on the inside of the shin, you got to be concerned about that. That's probably a stress reaction at the best.
Right.
You know, if it's bilateral, I'm not that worried. You know, a day or two off, you know, again, doing some massage treatment, self-care, Kelly Starlet, prehab stuff, all of a sudden it's probably going to go away. The other thing is as a coach, if all of your athletes are feeling it at the same time, you need to pay attention. You need mm-hmm. to be careful with your next couple of days. Like Tony says, don't let today ruin tomorrow. You mm-hmm. might've ruined tomorrow, but definitely don't let it ruin Wednesday or Thursday. You know, be smart. But then all those athletes, maybe 2 weeks later, PR. So sometimes, you know, you're getting this data and feedback and it's part of the necessary evil of growth. Like when we have delayed onset of muscle soreness, I don't want that at the end of the season. You know, we're going to ice bath. We're going to request that if the parents are okay with it, maybe we're taking some anti-inflammatories. Maybe we're spending more time static stretching or foam rolling. But we don't want to irritate with a deep tissue massage. We don't want to do all this kind of stuff at the end of the season.
Right.
But early in the season, I might want that soreness. I might want that DOMS because at a cellular level, that's the only way we're going to make growth and improvement happen. So sometimes we have to be a little bit sore to get through it. And then the good news is if you're smart, and I know I'm going off here, but if you have a good warm-up protocol, you can find out if they're favoring a leg or not. You can see if the amplitudes of their movements aren't good. You can see if they're grimacing. You can see if they're tight. And then that gives you an opportunity to intervene at the beginning of practice before you end up blowing them up by doing something that maybe could be fixed with one more day of recovery.
This is just music to my ears. And it goes back to everything we've talked about either, you know, on the episode or previous, where you have a therapist and you have a track coach. And when a therapist hears a track coach is doing some stuff, they get really, you know, hesitant. They're like, they shouldn't be doing that. Like, let me see the athlete. And then when a track coach, you know, hears like therapist has all these ideas about how to, you know, change practice or add this thing or take this thing away, they're like, no, let me do my thing. But you have made it so easy to blend the two, and you have made it easy for that bridge to be connected because you've done your homework, you've done your research, you've had trial and errors, and you have protocol. You know, when a sprint coach has a protocol for an injured athlete, it's like, wow, they actually like have, you know, they thought a lot about this, and they're not just willy-nilly pushing that performance piece and ignoring the health. So it sounds like you've had quite a bit of experience of figuring out how to make it the best situation for an athlete. And that involves you being involved in that rehab process.
Yeah, for sure. And again, the relationship drives it too. You know, it's important as the coach to spend some time with whoever your main PT person is. You know, I think it's beneficial to sit down and have a few man sodas, have food. You know, his wife was coach and track, you know, and I, you know, I have a book, you know, the Sprinter's Compendium. I bought her a free copy of the book and said, hey, I'm so glad your wife's coach and track. Here's a gift, you know, for all your work that you're doing. And I thank them all the time. And the problem is like, you know, sometimes you don't want to hear that. Sometimes the trainer does say something. You're like, oh man, come on. You know, like this is not the way it should be. You get feisty, right. You know, and that's natural. It's not like you're going to be perfect with this. And I am by no means perfect with it, but the more you have that relationship, the better prepared you are as a coach with protocols, you can then have a hand on the steering wheel
right
on that kid's road to recovery. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to get
you've earned it. You've earned that because you've put in the work, not demanded it because I'm the boss and anything I says goes. Big difference.
Correct. There. Correct.
Another thing I want to touch on before we go, I think this was in the virtual speed and power performance clinic that our good friend Tyler Germain put on. You said something along the lines of when you break a PR or a world record or something of that nature, like there's a neurological change in your body where like you're a new self. 3 or 5 years ago, I would have heard that. I'd be like, this guy's crazy. You're the same person. But the more I understand performance, mindset, psychology, neurology, I do think there is something to that. Can you expand a little bit more on that? And do you see the same thing when a person goes through an injury rehab process, like coming back from a major injury, things like that?
Yeah. So, I mean, good athletes are good athletes because they want to compete. They want to get after it. They want to constantly set, you know, new PRs and things like that. The problem is that that's really impossible, you know, and when you achieve that new performance, you are a new person. You're a new person psychologically because you've done something that you didn't do before. You've now done it. When you break 11 seconds in the 100 meter dash, that's a bragging point. You know, when I went over 300 pounds on the bench for the first time, like, and I could say it, look somebody in the eye and say, I bench 365 at 5'8" and 195 pounds. People are like, yeah, right. You know, and then they look at you and like, oh no, he's not kidding. He really doesn't, you know? And when you have that, there's this level of a different you, you're now in a different stratosphere. And with that, it comes initial excitement and satisfaction. But then immediately, if you're a neurotic person like me, it's like, okay, then how do I get to the next one? You know, what do I do to continue to get that next one? And naturally as human beings, we do that, which means we're going to throttle up even more. We're going to redline even more. We're going to put more pressure on ourselves, you know, and that's not always the case. Like week to week, you could see like there's a young lady who's broke the Netherlands record in the 400 meter dash. She's right at that point where she's going to go sub 50 in the 400 indoors. And that's a really fast time. But what's going to probably happen is she's not going to get there because she's already PR'd like three or four times this year. So to get to that next one is going to require a reset, going to require a little bit of time away, probably requires a little bit more additional load in maybe a function of let's go work on some weaknesses again. Let's prioritize those and come back. So as an athlete, you're going to be punching, pushing, stressing to try to get to that time. So what I want to do is get you past that point of I got to do it again and have you become more satisfied with it. And also from a training method standpoint, I'm not going to change my expectations in times that you're going to hit in practice either. So like, let's say like, okay, they just went from running 11.2 to 10.8. Right. That's a pretty big jump. And that's going to put you in a different training level. And so like when I tell you 95% of, you know, 11.2 versus 95% of 10.8, it's very different 95%. So I would rather carry that out minimum of one more week where the training looks like what the training was the week before. And the intensities are the same. The recoveries in between the intervals are the same. The order and rotation of the days are the same, and let you ride that out a little bit. And then I might not let you compete, or I'm going to have you compete in an off event so that there's not a stress to PR in this one again, and you have a little less psychological baggage to do it again. Because again, boyfriend could have been out on the track that day, sunny, tailwind, all this kind of stuff. It could have been a one-off. So what I want to do is get your floor up, and I want to get your average to be more repeatable at that level versus that just being a one thing. And the other problem that track and field athletes have, especially sprinters and distance runners, anything that has to do with running, is they'll think that that performance is a fluke. Well, it's our job to make sure that it's not a fluke. And the best way we can do that is by giving them a little bit of a break or repeating the stimulus, changing the event, and then giving them a couple of weeks for the body to adapt and giving them a better chance to get close to that performance again when you decide to put them back in that event. So that's incredibly important. When we talk about athletes coming off of injuries, that's tough. It's real tough because a lot of times, like when you're in the middle of the season, they're never really back. You know, how do I manage what they've done, where they're at, and how do I get them as close as I can to having a satisfactory performance for not just me, but for them, which requires, you know, being very judicious on what events do you put them in. Like if I'm going to bring an athlete back, I usually go from the longest thing that they can do down to the shortest thing. Because most of the time, the injuries that they have are related to explosive, powerful movements and actions.
Right.
And so And the thing is, as you and I both know, their aerobic system can hang in there a little bit longer than the neurological thing. Like, you got to be punching. Right. Like I always say, like, when it comes to neurological maximal effort pursuits, you're in a fight with gravity every day when your feet hits the ground. You know, you're in a fist fight for life, and you're in an endless fight with gravity. And until you go to bed, you know, and then you wake up, you repeat the fight. And so with that, it, those properties of the central nervous system, maximal output, maximal push, those things tend to slide, in my opinion, a lot quicker in the speed power events than the aerobic components and threshold components where you get from, you know, the ability to buffer lactic acid or hydrogen ions, your, you know, cardiovascular system. Like if you're a distance runner, you get 28 days to peak. So that can be there. And I feel like you can be a little bit more successful in the longer stuff because there's less people that do the longer stuff. And then you can trust they can handle the intensity, the amplitudes of the movement, mm-hmm. the striking at a slower speed.
Right.
Then, okay, now I trust you there. Let's move down to the next one and see if you can handle the amplitude, the speed, the striking and single leg support for a little bit faster and a little bit faster. And one of the things I've found, Tom, is when I run across a kid who has a hamstring injury and they feel great in practice, traditionally, I don't think they're safe to run off a hamstring for two more weeks. They're safe to run in practice. They're safe to train in practice, but they're not safe to sprint because they're going to want to sprint against the competition and right. you're going to want to put them in at a seed time of what they were going to do. That's mm-hmm. all bad. Don't do that. You know, make sure the seed time is really slow. Put them in a no time as long as they get to race against somebody. You could put them on a longer relay on a leg that typically isn't a stress leg. So like if you had a 4x2 in your state and you got a sprinter, you could put them on a 4x2. You put them in a 4x4, you know, and put them on the third leg, bury them and help them get their confidence back, you know, versus having them have to come out of the blocks, push, run upright, the stress of that, you know, from a standing start versus a flying start. I feel flying starts are actually a little safer, you know, when it comes to some of that stuff. So those are the things that I would be very curious and you know, trying to do. And again, then it would be like the reverse process. Okay. Can you walk? Great. Can you dribble? Great. Can you jog? Great. Can you sprint? Okay. Now we're in a good spot. And you say you feel good. Well, we got about a week or two to go, but we can commence training again. And then the other thing is I for sure, once they can start running again, I'm not running every day. You know, right. they might warm up every day. They might go through some drills every day, but we're going to make sure that we're not running every day. So they have Monday, they run. Tuesday, they don't run other than warming up, stretching out, being a part of the team, being in the community. Then Wednesday, they come back. They might do a little bit more.
That's absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Did that stuff come naturally to you when you started coaching, or did it take a couple failures, a couple setbacks to be like, oh, we actually need a week or two here, or we need, you know, every other day here? Did that kind of come, you know, through trial and error?
Well, for me, I was hurt throughout my high school career. So I was really, really fast as a freshman. And I broke our school's time trial record in the 200. And then I tore my hamstring three times in a matter of a month and a half. I re-injured it. One was on spring break, being an idiot, you know, trying to show off for girls on the beach, running routes with my buddy, hurt it. Then flirting with a girl, you can catch a theme here, flirting with a girl outside of English class. And I had two tardies and the third one was going to be a detention. So I turn really fast and basically try to jump in the door, hurt it again. Then finally, after enough time, I was able to come back and run in this goofy freshman race. And the track that we were running on was shaped like a digital zero. It had four straightaways coming off the, you know, the second to last straightaway, coming to the, you know, the part where the race gets uncomfortable in right. the 400. I pulled it again. The other problem is mechanically back in the day, if you would have seen me run, I ran really strange. I didn't move well. And so I knew that was something that had to be addressed all the time. if an athlete cooled down in my program, I wasn't going to make them re-warm up and do whatever they did. You know, it's, that's my job as the coach to be clearly explicit on what my expectations are for the menu in practice. If not, I'm going to send them home. Cause there were two different times competitively. The very first time that year, my sophomore year, where I tore it, my friend heard it pop and that freaked me out, you know? And I was after I had already done a triple jump session. Okay. Which was an all day plyometric exhaustive thing, right. Multiple run throughs to try to get on the board. And then he's like, and I cooled down. It's like, oh, now you got to go do handoffs. Well, and then I had to run on the curve. I'm getting a handoff from a guy who could run, you know, 1080 FAT in high school. It's a very fast guy. And I'm trying to get out and I can't get out. And I'm on a curve and I'm tired and pow, it popped. Same thing in college, same thing, relays. You know, they wanted me to do a relay. I'd already cooled down. I was exhausted. Sure enough, got hurt. You know, so some of my own personal experience led me to an obsession. So right. Like, I know that there are coaches that say, well, I can get a practice done in 45 minutes. My warmup is 45 minutes long. And we rotate the type of warmups that we do from a dynamic to a static. And again, you know, why do I do that? Well, each individual fiber has different components to it that requires a different type of stretch. And because of that, then your warmup needs to deal with those different types of things. And then I try to be conscientious of, like we talked about with rehab, I rotate those packages every 48 hours, 24 hours. So they don't see it for every 48 hours. And we have an A and a B. So then the body even gets recovery in that system right. of movement and biomechanics every other day. And so some of this was my own experience. Some of this, like you talked about, we talked about offline, is finding great methods outside of track and field from other people. Mm-hmm. Some of it is looking at the biology and the function of the biology. Hey, we need to move forward, backwards, and side to side, and up and down. So your warm-ups should include up and down, forward and backwards, and side to side to address that. And those, like American football, the defensive backs are the ones who rarely, rarely pull a hamstring. Well, why is that? They spend just as much time running forward and side to side and backwards as everybody else. So then I was like, well, that makes sense. Even though track and field is for the most part, a linear sport, if I want to save these kids' hamstrings, I want each of these individual fibers to get the things they need in suppleness. Mm-hmm. I want the athlete mechanically to have a different thing they're looking at every other day and then relax the other system. I want the movement patterns to address movements in all different directions so that my athletes are built and robust. And I do that when we run some workouts. Again, tempo allows you to do it a little easier. I run counterclockwise and clockwise on the track, so that their athletes have days where they're not continually overloading the left side of their body, the inside leg that is doing a lot of torsion and contorting. I want them to have that on the other side to create some bilateral balance. Mm-hmm. So we do that as well. All this is probably, this was by no means did I know this stuff. It's trial and error. Again, like we talked about, and I'm sorry to cut you off, Tom. To the problem presents itself. Okay. So the solutions are always going to be different, but the method to find the solution needs to be repeatable.
I think the best coaches have had personal struggles, whether injury or performance wise in their own career. And that just creates that burning drive, that burning desire to get better, to never stop, to always help as many people as they can. And you're one of those coaches. You never stop helping other people, whether it's through your podcast, through your writing, through your coaching. Thank you for taking time for jumping on the podcast, Ryan. I really appreciate you and have a wonderful rest of your day.
Absolutely, Tom. Thank you so much. And thank you, the audience, for listening in. And feel free to reach out if you have any questions.